I'd like you to join me in Genesis 47:13. We're going to kind of scroll back just a little bit to get the context back in our heads for this part of the story. We've already seen Joseph prepare Egypt for the upcoming famine. He spent the 7 years of extraordinary plenty squirreling away an awful lot of excess produce. In fact, at that time, they were gathering 20% of everyone's production in order to put it in storehouses all over the Delta and all up and down the Nile so that it would be available once the drought hit in earnest and the famine began. Well, we don't know for absolute certain who that Pharaoh was that first elevated Joseph to vizier status, because there's a little diciness, I think, in some of the dating from this time in Egypt's history. But it is interesting that there are several pharaohs that were involved in production of grain for the benefit of the people during the window that we're kind of talking about here. It is, I think, possible that Joseph began his service under the man we know as Senusret II. Now, he is known for making extensive upgrades to the Fayum Oasis region, which is about 40 miles southwest of where Cairo is today, and not very far from where the capital of this particular dynasty was located. And his intention in doing that was to significantly increase agricultural production, which you would almost see that Joseph would want to do that during the 7 good years so that they could pump up even more for being stored away. Now, he was followed by his son, that is Senusret III, who is the one that is given credit for bringing all of Egypt under the control of the singular crown of Lower Egypt, that is Northern Egypt. And so that is exactly what we see happening in the story next. So that is what gives me confidence that we're in the right region here when we're talking about the mid-1800s, or the second half of the first half, so the second quarter of the 1800s BC. So with that kind of behind us, let's see how Joseph, acting on behalf of his Pharaoh, brings the crown, or brings all of the different regions of Lower Egypt under a singular crown. Genesis 47:13. Now there was no food in all the land, for the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished by reason of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan in exchange for the grain that they bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. So sometime after the second year, because that's when Joseph brings his family to Egypt, so maybe the third or the fourth year, the Egyptians, some of whom are kind of like mini-lords over little regions there in the Delta or up and down the Nile, they start running out of whatever supplies they had laid in during the good years. And they have to tap into the national supply, and they have to pay for it in silver. Verse 15, When the money was all spent in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, so this would be in the year or two that follows, after they've used up all of their silver resources in tapping into this national storehouse. All the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, "Give us food. Why should we die before your eyes? For our money is gone." And so Joseph answered, "Give your livestock, and I'll give you food in exchange for your livestock if your money is gone." So Joseph's response is, okay, you do not have precious metal. Let's switch over to livestock. Give us your livestock in exchange for the grain that you need to eat and the grain you'll need to plant once we've moved beyond this famine. So they agree to this. They brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them food in exchange for the horses, the flocks, the herds, and the donkeys. They were over a barrel, but this is also something that would allow them to make their grain stocks go farther if they're not having to feed these animals. In a later story in the Old Testament, we have King Ahab, during an extreme famine, going around with his advisors, deciding whether or not they needed to start killing off the livestock in order to use it for meat, but also to not have to feed them. So these are the sorts of decisions you have to make when you're in dire straits. So Joseph takes these animals, and he supplied them with food in exchange for all their livestock that year. And when that year was ended, so we are now probably in the sixth year, maybe moving toward the seventh, but we're definitely far enough along that they have used up everything of value, and they still have more remaining of the great drought and famine. So when that year was ended, they came to him the following year and said to him, "We will not hide from my lord that our money is spent. The herds of livestock are my lord's. There is nothing left in the sight of my lord but our bodies and our land. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for food, and we with our land will be servants to Pharaoh. Give us seed that we may live and not die, and that the land may not be desolate." So Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. So this is the consolidation of all the little mini regions of the Delta and up and down the Nile River, up to the first cataract probably. This is all Lower Egypt. This is how all of that became the personal property of the Pharaoh, which is exactly what history tells us happened during the time of Senusrit III. So Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for all the Egyptians sold their fields because the famine was severe on them. The land became Pharaoh's. And as for the people, he made servants of them from one end of Egypt to the other. So we have what in some places have been referred to as a feudalism. The Pharaoh owns all the property. He owns all the livestock. He owns all the resources, including the seed stock. And everybody is employed by him pretty much as a tenant farmer or a tenant husbandman. Running animals on his behalf, running his animals. And so everybody works for Pharaoh. And will have to pay him something of what they produce as his tenant farmers or tenant animal workers. Now, there's one exception to this. Verse 22, only the land of the priests did he not buy, for the priest had a fixed allowance from Pharaoh and lived on the allowance that Pharaoh gave them. Therefore, they did not sell their land. So the land of the priests was, in the mind of Pharaoh, the land that belonged to the gods. And so the land of the divine is tax immune. The land of the divine is to be held sacrosanct, absolutely holy, and off limits. And so that is the only exception to this. The priests will continue to work for their gods and goddesses and their properties that they live on and work on will be considered the properties of the gods and the goddesses. But everybody else is living on Pharaoh land and they are Pharaoh's slaves. Now, verse 23, Joseph said to the people, "Behold, I have this day bought you and your land for Pharaoh. Now, here is seed for you, and you shall sow the land." So now we've kind of come to the end of the 7 years of drought, and now we're ready to plant for the first year of recovery from the drought. And it is clear that we have a tenant-farmer situation. The land belongs to Pharaoh, but it will be worked by Pharaoh's servants. The house that they live in belong to Pharaoh. Everything, the animals they use, belongs to Pharaoh. The equipment they use, all of it belongs to Pharaoh. And so Pharaoh gives them seed stock. And Joseph sets the ratio of what they have to give to Pharaoh out of each year's crop that they produce. The rest they can keep for their own use, for future production, and any excess beyond that, the Pharaoh will allow them to use for whatever they wish to do. So that's the arrangement that they've run into here. And Joseph is the one that comes up with it. And it is very similar, the percentage, to what he did to prepare for the disaster in the first place. Verse 24, at the harvest, you shall give a fifth, or more easily remembered, 20%. At the harvest time, you shall give 20% to Pharaoh, and 80% shall be your own as seed for the field, so that's your seed stock for the following year, as food for yourselves, so that's your maintenance, and your households, and as food for your little ones. And they said, "You have saved our lives. May it please your Lord, we will be servants to Pharaoh." And so Joseph effectively sets up a tenant farming system in Egypt. That is what will exist all the way up till the time of the Exodus, 430 years later. And in a way, this really makes it possible for when God brings his plagues against Egypt and against the Egyptian gods and against the Pharaoh, that the perception is that this is only against the Pharaoh and his gods because he's the one that's being harmed. They are the ones being harmed because everybody else just works for the Pharaoh. And so when the economy collapses at the end of the 10 plagues, then that makes it much easier for the Israelis to leave without any type of reprisals from the people of Egypt generally, because the big ones that were harmed was the Pharaoh himself, since he owns everything. Verse 26, so Pharaoh, Joseph made it a statute concerning the land of Egypt, and it stands to this day. That's Moses writing, remember. He says, this is the way it's working right now as I'm writing this for you Israelis coming out of Egypt. You know this. The land of the priests alone did not become Pharaoh's. Everybody else, they paid the 20%. And thus, Israel settled in the land of Egypt, in the land of Goshen. Now, you may not think about this, but they will start out paying 20% of their income to Pharaoh because they are living on Pharaoh's property and in Goshen. They're living in houses that belong to Pharaoh. Now, the only thing that they have different than the Israelis is they actually have their own livestock that are not sold to Pharaoh, because Joseph is providing for his family. So the Israelis do not at first become the slaves of Pharaoh, nor do they sell their property or their animals or anything of value to Pharaoh. So they are the only ones kind of in this region and at this time that survive this absorption of the working people into the crown of the Pharaoh. Now, verse number 28 tells us, I need to finish up verse 27 first. They gained possessions in it and were fruitful, and they multiplied greatly. So that is now starting to get us ready for the story of the Exodus that happens 430 years after the Israelis arrived in Egypt. You remember we had a number of 70 men that are connected with the Israelis first establishing themselves in the land of Goshen. By the time we get to the Exodus, the numbers of men who are to receive farms, inheritance in the Promised Land, is over 600,000. And so we have a huge growth of people. We've got to have each family pretty much having 10 or more kids. Those kids get married and having a whole bunch of kids themselves in order to reach the sort of numbers we're going to be talking about in the time of the Exodus. And that is what is described here. They were fruitful and they multiplied greatly. Now, verse 28 says, Jacob lived in the land of Egypt for 17 years. And this is where we're going to transition now to the next big story, which is the death and burial of Jacob / Israel. So he lives a total of 17 years in Egypt, seeing his grandsons and some of his great-grandsons growing up there in the land of Goshen, in the Nile Delta. And then he passes away. So the days of Jacob, the years of his life, were 147 years. And when the time drew near that Israel must die, he called his son Joseph and said to him, so Israel, Jacob, senses that his time is near. We don't know how. We don't know what prompted him to believe this and it to be accurate, but he summons his favorite son, born to his beloved wife, Rachel. And when he does this, we see his intention is to give Joseph a type of inheritance that is a double portion, just like Judah is going to get, because he is the official heir, being the fourth son of Leah, the senior wife, and the one that had the blessing and the firstborn right has passed to. Joseph is going to receive a double portion as well. And this is the backdoor way that Jacob does that. He said to him, "Now, if I have found favor in your sight, put your hand under my thigh and promise to deal kindly and truly with me." Now, the last time we saw something like this was with Abraham, remember, making his servant take an oath, which we talked about it being kind of a symbolic way of swearing by the family jewels, swearing by the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and now Jacob. So making sure that this is a binding promise. And then he says this, "Do not bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers. Carry me out of Egypt, bury me in their burying place." So he says, "You got to swear to me that you will not let my dead body stay here in Egypt. I want to be buried in the Machpelah cave. I want to be buried with my family members." And so Joseph answered, "I will do as you have said." And Israel said, "Swear to me." And so he swore to him. And then Israel bowed himself upon the head of his bed. Now, some of the Bible versions have staff here, which I think is probably the better choice, that basically Israel is kind of bedridden right now, but he has gotten himself up on the side of the bed, and he's holding on to his personal staff as a sort of support. Chapter 48. After this, Joseph was told, "Behold, your father is ill." So he already knew that dad is thinking his time for passing is close. He swore to him, "When you die, I promise by the family jewels, I'll take you back to Cave Machpelah." And so now he's getting the news that it's closer. So he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. Now by this time, these boys who were born during the good years, they have got to be in their upper teens at the youngest, but more likely in their 20s, their early 20s. That's how old they have to be. And so he brings his sons with him, and it was told to Jacob, "Your son Joseph has come to you." And so Israel summoned his strength and sat up in bed. So here we go again, probably holding on to his staff in order to get upright. Jacob said to Joseph, "El Shaddai," that is, "my God." That's the way the Septuagint translates El Shaddai. "My God, the God of my chest." Some of your versions will give a footnote about this means, this is the idea of the God of the chest muscles, the strong chest muscles, so God Almighty. So "El Shaddai appeared to me at Luz," that's the old name of Bethel, "in the land of Canaan, and he blessed me. And he said, 'Behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will make you a company of peoples, and will give you this land to your offspring after you for an everlasting possession.'" So Jacob, Israel, goes back over to the promise made to Abraham, Isaac, and then Jacob himself. Says, "God has promised that our family line is going to be fruitful, We'll be like the stars of the sky. We'll be like the sand on the seashore, not wanting to try to number it. And he is going to make people groups come out of this family line, tribal groups. And then he's going to give this promised land of Canaan into our everlasting possession. Now, that's all preamble to his backdoor way of giving Joseph a double portion of that promise, of that inheritance. Verse 5, now, your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine as Reuben and Simeon are. The children that you fathered after them shall be yours. They shall be called by the names of their brothers in their inheritance. And so this is his backdoor way. He disinherits, technically, Joseph. Says, I am not going to give you anything, which is no big deal because Joseph is super, super rich already as the vizier of Egypt. He says, what I'm going to do is I am going to adopt your two oldest boys and make them full sons of mine. And I will give each of them a portion of inheritance, which technically means Joseph shall receive a double portion, just like Judah will receive a double portion as the technical heir. So it is it's quite a bit of Jacobing. It's the leg puller thing all over again. It's the making sure that you get what you're looking for by whatever means. Now, that may seem like a strong critique, but it is an honest critique. It is certainly the way that Jacob makes Joseph his favorite son, the son of the special coat, his heir.